This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is out this week. And welcome to the final Friday of 2012. And what a year it's been. Big political stories from the re-election of President Barack Obama to an historic Senate election here in Massachusetts.
And despite the odds, you elected the first woman senator to the state of Massachusetts.
Elizabeth Warren's victory meant defeat for Scott Brown, but not necessarily goodbye.
Defeat is temporary. You know, depending on what happens and where we go, all of us, we may obviously meet again.
It was also a year of big scandals in Massachusetts. At the state crime lab, where a rogue chemist compromised tens of thousands of criminal drug samples.
Her behavior has corrupted the integrity of the criminal justice system and the public's perception of it.
And at a Framingham-based compounding pharmacy, where contamination caused a deadly outbreak of fungal meningitis.
There are going to be, in large organizations, things that go wrong. We hope that when things go wrong, they don't result in deaths, as has been the case.
And as the year drew to a close and the holidays approached, a shocking slaughter of school children and their teachers in Connecticut, and a new resolve, perhaps, to confront America's gun culture.
We can't tolerate this anymore. These tragedies must end. And to end them, we must change.
Today on Radio Boston, we're considering the big local stories in our year in review. And joining me are two members of our regular Week in Review panel, John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the man behind the blogs CampaignOutsider.com and It's Good to Live in a TwoDailyTown.com. John Carroll, that's always a mouthful, but it's great to have you in. Thank you for
Thanks.
Coming.
Thanks. Always good to be here.
And Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston, which is so much easier to say, and columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, great to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And before we dive in and tackle the big stories of 2012, let's spend just a few minutes with some of the news from this week. And it looks like the race to replace U.S. Senator John Kerry, who's expected to be confirmed as the next Secretary of State, is on. Just yesterday, Congressman Ed Markey, a Democrat, became the first to jump into a race that could also include Republican Scott Brown and an assortment of other Democrats. So let's talk about Markey. He's the dean of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. He's got money. He's got experience. He knows how Washington works. What do you think, Renee, of Ed Markey's prospects?
Well, you know, the Democrats are all very nervous about a primary. They're all trying to avoid it. They want to, you know, consolidate quickly and get together behind one candidate, presumably somebody like Markey, who has a lot of strengths. Yeah, but I'm just not sure I agree with that. I mean, I think that Markey is somebody who's never run statewide. He's not that well known outside of his district, even despite a long career in politics in the state. And a good primary, if it's well fought, you know, and if it's intelligently done, can really increase the interest in the race. It's going to be a special election, you know, in a kind of an off time, some May or June. And there could be, you know, a rise in interest. We saw this when Barack Obama was running against Hillary Clinton in 2008. Everyone was all nervous about the, you know, long primary race, but it ended up increasing the number of registrations and getting people really excited about the race.
It's interesting, John, because, I mean, Renee makes a good point. On the other hand, you can talk to some sort of party folks who say, no, let's avoid a destructive primary where folks are going to tear each other apart so that we can be ready for the Republican when the special election comes. What do you think?
You could see that happening if it weren't that Ed Markey is the first one to jump in. Ed Markey is tailor-made for Scott Brown. He is the ideal opponent in terms of how Scott Brown would look at them. If I were the Democrats, I would think, I don't want to settle for Ed Markey. Let him fight his way to the to the nomination. That's fine. But they shouldn't cede this to him, because I think that he could be really easy pickings for Scott Brown. He's partisan. He's a career insider. He's taken money from all the usual suspects, you know, from Wall Street to the telecommunications industry. Scott Brown would have a field day with him, and I think that that's got to be one of the considerations, whether you get bloodied up in a primary or not.
And what about the other Democrats? Congressman Mike Capuano and Congressman Stephen Lynch are two names that are being talked about. Capuano ran the last time. Stephen Lynch, a known moderate. Renee, What do you make of those two names or other names that are being talked about?
Well, you know, both those candidates are far more kind of scrappy. You might even say truculent, belligerent. You know, how else, what are the words you would use to describe their personalities, especially in contrast to Markey, who is a much, I don't know, sort of calmer and more cerebral kind of candidate. So they would really run a kind of a scrappy campaign. And, you know, I think, you know, people may that may appeal to the voters. They're in a kind of a angry and unhappy mood. And sometimes, you know, it's good for the candidate to reflect the angry mood of the populace. I don't know how well either one of them would do in the Senate, which is a much clubbier and, in the past anyway, much more collegial kind of body than the scrappier House. But as candidates, I think they'd have a lot of fire.
John, what do you see among these other candidates, these other potential possible candidates?
Yeah, this has really unleashed the great mentioner, as William Safire used to say. I think you heard all kinds of names bandied about, from Steve Pagliacci to Pagliarulo.
Pagliucci, wasn't it?
Pagliucci, right. Yeah. Sorry. I was closer to the beginning.
Yeah, that guy.
to Dave D'Alessandro, to Martha Coakley, perhaps, for a rematch, to Barney Frank, which is one of the most intriguing ones.
That's intriguing.
Because Ed Markey had a lot to do with how the congressional districts were redistricted this time around, and he threw a number of people under the bus, most obviously Barney Frank. And so there is a revenge factor that would play right into Barney Frank's natural strengths, which is, you know, revenge and vituperation.
Well, and smarts. Let's not forget that. I mean, I think Barney Frank, I don't think he's going to do it, because I think
he's made it pretty clear that he wants out, an arrest and a break from this.
Yeah,
from
you
this
know,
world.
I mean, I think he's put in a long career, but I thought, you know, he'd be an amazing, very interesting candidate against Scott Brown.
Well, speaking of Scott Brown, of course, the money is on him that he will jump into this race. What kind of advantages or baggage from his last race does he bring, Renee?
Yeah, I do think there could be some sympathy vote for him. You know, I mean, there are people who, you know, liked him well enough but got more excited about Warren and, you know, a big Democratic push because it was a presidential campaign, you know, sort of brought her over onto the beach, you know, kind of big tidal wave of Democratic votes. And people may be feeling a little bit, you know, a little bit of, what is it called, buyer's regret or something, why can't we just have both of these good candidates? So I think that could help him. I also, though, think that his campaign revealed him to be not that likable a guy. It was one of the things that really he had going for him his whole political career, is that he was a good guy, a nice guy. You know, the rough and tumble of the campaign really revealed him to be, you know, not so nice.
Yeah. What do you think, John? What kind of baggage from that last race?
Well, that's exactly the baggage that he's gotten. And the reason he has it is because of the People's Pledge. That was probably the biggest mistake he ever made in
his
political career.
This was not to accept right. outside funding. Right?
Right. And he thought it was very clever when he initiated it, because he thought, you know, there's going to be all this Democratic money coming in here, and you know, I want to keep that out.
Yeah.
As it turned out, he underestimated how much Democratic money there would be from third-party groups as opposed to Republican money. Democrats had lunch money compared to the Republicans. And also, he didn't take into account what a fabulous fundraiser Elizabeth Warren turned out to be. Mm-hmm. So whereas Karl Rove should have been coming in and doing his dirty work for him and being the attack dog, Scott Brown had to do his own dirty work himself. And it came across as very unpleasant and very off-putting, especially in the debates, but also in the ads, the barrage of ads, all of which were attached to Scott Brown, as opposed to maybe being sloughed off to a third party.
Finally, in terms of news today, we should talk about the news out of Washington, such as it is. Congressional leaders and President Obama have just 4 more days to reach an agreement on taxes and spending. Otherwise, over the cliff we go. Taxes go up. Defense and domestic spending will be slashed by 10%. President Obama has summoned congressional leaders to the White House. They're meeting as we speak. And yesterday, I like this detail in this morning's newspaper. Dr. Ruth Westheimer, the famous sex therapist, tweeted that lawmakers who can't compromise probably aren't good lovers. So it's come to that. And let me ask you both, do you think we're going to get a last-minute deal out of this or not, Renee?
Oh, I I find that really hard to predict. But part of me just wants to, reprise the old children's rhyme. You know, who's afraid of the fiscal cliff? I mean, I sort of feel like let's just go over the darn thing and deal with it on the other end. You know, there are actually some advantages politically to doing that. You know, the Republicans will be in a very different position then. They'll be in a position of being able to cut taxes as opposed to raising them on the rich because everyone's tax breaks go away. And so I think, we may end up finding a way through this once we go over the cliff. I mean, it's just so disheartening, though, because it's a creation of the Congress
it
itself.
Really is, I know.
To force themselves to do some, hard work, and they still can't do it even when their own artificial deadline has arrived.
John, what do you see on this sort of last-ditch effort here?
Yeah, I think that each side is willing to go over the cliff. Each side has no problem going over the cliff. Each side is actually thinking no deal is better than a bad deal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they look at all these bad possibilities out there, and they think, I'd rather just go over the cliff. The Democrats, I think Renee had it just right with the Republicans, that they get to blame the tax hike on Obama. They get to come in next year and cut it for most Americans. The Democrats, it's a dream come true. $2.8 trillion over the next 10 years in additional revenues. I mean, for them, it's the gift that keeps on giving. I'm not sure that they ever want to go back and cut them again.
Well, we'll see where it all goes. But it's interesting that this is a time when optimists in Washington dig up some pretty good phrases and look for sources of optimism where they can. So I want to end this section of the show with Oklahoma Republican Tom Cole. He's an ally of House Speaker John Boehner, speaking yesterday on MSNBC. Let's listen.
I actually think there's still a chance to get something done. And these deals usually come together at the last moment. That's what happened in the budget deal, the debt ceiling deal. I think that's what's going to happen again. To paraphrase Ronald Reagan, there's so much manure around here, there's got to be a pony someplace.
So I guess that's as good as it gets right now, equating what these guys are producing with pony manure. But there we have it. Renee Loth, John Carroll, stand by. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll dive right into the big stories of 2012 and look ahead to the new year. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're back with our year in review, a look at some of the big local stories of 2012 on this final Friday of the year. With me are John Carroll and Renee Loth, and let's start with the big political story in Massachusetts, which came to a head last month with the election of Elizabeth Warren as the state's first female senator.
An amazing campaign. And let me be clear, I didn't build that. You built that. You took on the powerful Wall Street banks and special interests, and you let them know you want a senator who'll be out there fighting for the middle class all of the time.
So an historic victory there. Let me start the question this way, though. I'm struck by, Massachusetts, this long record of relative progressive politics, whether it's the only state in the union that supported George McGovern, the first state to legalize gay marriage, universal health care, and yet it took so long to get around to electing a woman to the U.S. Senate. Why? And what's the significance of this election victory, Renee Loth?
Well, it took a long time because there aren't that many Senate seats that open up very often in Massachusetts or anywhere else. There's only two of them. But It let's be honest, it has taken a long time for Massachusetts to elect women to statewide office. And, Elizabeth Warren is still new enough to be considered a maverick in that realm. I think it's because politics in Massachusetts ain't beanbag, to quote that old chestnut. It's a powerful business. It really means a lot to have a political seat in Massachusetts. In New Hampshire nearby last year, maybe it was 2 years ago, the legislature had a female head of their House, head of their Senate. Governors, all kinds of women up there because there's not a lot of power in Massachusetts, in New Hampshire government. So, I think the game is worth the candle here. And so I think that's why it's been difficult to get women to break through.
John Carroll, what's your sort of assessment of this big political story of this year?
Yeah, I think there's an all-boys club, and it's hard to break into, and I think they haven't had the right candidates, frankly. I mean, I think Martha Coakley was mismatched in terms of the special election. That was the best shot that a woman would have had. It's still sort of odd and sort of unbelievable that she let that seat slip away. Mm-hmm. As far as the race overall went, I mean, this is a Democratic state, so the numbers were in Elizabeth Warren's favor. I remember Renee and I had a conversation a while back, and I thought Scott Brown had a better chance than he did. I had no idea that Elizabeth Warren was going to be the sort of rock star on the campaign trail mm-hmm. that she was not, frankly, on TV in her ads. And one of the best things they did was take her out of her own ads and basically turn them over to the people who supported her. Because I think what happened is it gave her a much better image. It gave her a much stronger image. And it also illustrated the connection that she had made with people out on the trail, a connection that she was unable to make through the television medium. So I think a lot of things fell together for her, but I think in the end, it's hard to beat a Democrat in Massachusetts, and it just goes to show how distinctive the campaign was that Scott Brown first ran in the special election with a much lower turnout, obviously, but it does cast that in sort of a whole new light.
Well, speaking of Elizabeth Warren, let's look forward a little bit into the new year. She'll be sitting on the Senate Banking Committee, which will provide her access to issues that she spent a lifetime preparing for, or at least half a lifetime preparing for. What kind of senator do you expect her to be, Renee?
I think it's so interesting. I mean, this is, to me, even more interesting than the campaign, to see what kind of senator Elizabeth Warren will be. Will she be captured by Washington? Will she become, kind of a workhorse than a show horse? Will she, this is probably sexist to say this, but, will she follow in the footsteps of Hillary Clinton, who was very polite and calm and quiet and, not too much of a show horse, learned how to do her hard work? She certainly capable of that, Elizabeth Warren is, or will she really go down there with guns blazing and be the kind of fiery advocate that she promised to be in the campaign?
John?
Yeah, I think that she's looking to set up a power base. She's already set up a PAC called PAC for a Level Playing Field, and I think that it's going to be interesting to see what money goes into that PAC. I'd be very interested in their campaign finance reports. And also, there is the possibility of the payback factor. Elizabeth Warren went down there as a consumer advocate and went to hearings and made a number of enemies and put a number of noses out of joint. And I think that there may be some kind of a sense of, we want to get ours back now at this point, which will put her in a difficult position. It's going to make her be a lot scrappier and more aggressive, perhaps, than she might otherwise be. A lot of it will depend on how I think the other players down there react to her.
Well, it'll be an interesting story to follow in 2013. So let's move on from that to the two big stories that seem to be about a failure of oversight at the state level. The first involved the state crime lab in Boston, where one rogue chemist apparently mishandled thousands of drug samples. The result, thousands of prosecutions have been compromised, could be overturned. Here's the state's Attorney General, Martha Coakley.
Any case where someone has been convicted based upon evidence that is inaccurate, has been tampered with, is not acceptable. We need to rectify it. And so it's a long process, but we're committed to it and we will get it done.
A long process that's underway, but it was followed pretty quickly by a deadly national fungal meningitis outbreak that was traced back to the New England Compounding Company in Framingham. So the fallout of these stories is far from over. John, how is it all going to play out in the coming year?
Well, I think the drug lab is the one that's going to have the most lasting effect. And Deval Patrick has asked the legislature for $30 million to deal with all these cases that are likely going to have to be retried or at least reassessed. I think it's going to cost a lot more than that. I think estimates of $100 million, I think, are probably more in the ballpark. And I think that this casts the entire law enforcement and judicial system in Massachusetts into some kind of doubt. I mean, one of the interesting things was that emails came out in the past couple of weeks that Annie Dugan had sent to a number of assistant district attorneys. And the sense that she felt that she was on the prosecution team, that she was basically working with them to put people in jail was something that is very disquieting. And I think that's going to give people a lot of people pause about, you know, just how fair is the justice system here in Massachusetts, and call into question not only the drug lab, but also the district attorney's office and the various prosecution teams, and to look into what their involvement is here and how much encouragement they gave to Annie Dugan or anybody else in those terms.
It is a really, really troubling story that's going to go on and on. Renee, though, I'd love your comments on these two sort of cases of oversight stories.
First of all, I just wanted to say about Annie Dugan that she, you know, she was indicted earlier this month on charges of evidence tampering and obstruction of justice. And, it is true that the whole criminal justice system has been called into question here. I think that there's a lot of anger in the criminal justice system toward Annie Dugan, though.
Sure,
I mean, I think that she's going to have a difficult time of it as well. Of course, in the Annie Dugan scandal, nobody has died yet, and 37 people died in the meningitis compounding scandal, which in many ways is much worse, a little bit more difficult to understand. We have a very complicated system of drug compounding in this state. You know, there are state regulations, there's federal regulations. They don't always match. I think there's some big problems ahead there. People don't even agree on what this compounding firm was. Was it a pharmacy, in which case it should have state regulation, or was it more like a manufacturer, in which case it should have federal regulation? I mean, it's a very complicated story and very disturbing, and I have to say politically I'm surprised at how well Governor Patrick has so far weathered these two storms.
Well, I want to talk about that, actually, because as we know, a couple of weeks ago, Governor Patrick announced a major shakeup of his cabinet, replacing four cabinet secretaries, most significantly Health and Human Services Secretary Judy Ann Bigby and Public Safety Secretary Mary Elizabeth Heffernan. Patrick stopped well short of saying that these folks were sacked because of the scandals, but here's what he said.
There's always going to be news, some of it real, some of it concocted. There's always going to be news. But I have been proud of the leadership of each of these members of the cabinet and those that remain, and I'm looking forward to the leadership of the new ones.
So, John, Renee suggested how well Governor Patrick has weathered this. Where does all this leave him as he begins his final 2 years in office?
Well, he's weathered this well because he hasn't come under a whole lot of scrutiny or criticism, but this has been framed in many ways as sort of falling in the cracks between the FDA and the Mass Pharmacy Board. But the truth of the matter is that California and South Carolina were in almost exactly the same position with compounders a few years ago, and they cracked down and they drove these compounders out of business, the ones who they found irregularities with. And Massachusetts did not. And I don't think that part's been emphasized enough, that essentially Massachusetts made choices all the way along not to take a punitive action, not to take some kind of or exercise some kind of stricter oversight and demand action from New England Compounding Center. And I think that you've got this sort of template that was established in California and South Carolina that Massachusetts chose not to follow. And I think that there hasn't been enough accountability or sort of scrutiny of that part of it as there might have been.
Well, when we're talking about the big stories of 2012, we have to talk about the terrible events in Newtown, Connecticut of 2 weeks ago, when a young gunman, Adam Lanza, used an assault rifle to shoot and kill 20 children, as well as the principal and teachers at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. The slaughter has renewed a debate about gun control across the country. Here's President Obama speaking shortly after the tragedy.
In the coming weeks, I'll use whatever power this office holds to engage my fellow citizens, from law enforcement to mental health professionals to parents and educators, in an effort aimed at preventing more tragedies like this. Because what choice do we have?
Well, in the past, the choice has been to do pretty much nothing about gun control and just wait for the next mass shooting. Renee, do you think this is going to be any different this time around?
Well, I just don't know. I mean, I think this is another example where we really need a federal response, because Massachusetts has good fairly good, strong laws. Connecticut had good, strong gun control laws, and it didn't stop this, you know, awful tragedy. I think we need a federal response, but I also want to just be realistic and say that there were something close to 300 million guns in this country out there right now. And if they stopped manufacturing all guns tomorrow and then did some sort of massive buyback program, it would still take a long time to keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. So, I mean, I think we have been, we're now reaping the bitter fruit of a very bad series of decisions made along the line. Mm.
John, your response to this huge story of 2012 and how it plays out in the year ahead.
I'd love to be an optimist, but I'm not, sort of by nature. And all, if something can't happen this time, when the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is its own worst enemy, they could not be more boneheaded or outrageous in their response to this. If that doesn't trigger some action, if that doesn't bring some meaningful change, then I don't think there's any situation that would. If the politicians can't get some backbone here and look at the NRA and say, you know what, you're not going to run us this time. You know, we're going to run you. Unless that happens, I just don't see I don't see any change at all. This is the most extreme case that you can possibly imagine in terms of the heinous crime and in terms of the response of the NRA. And if this one doesn't turn it, I don't know what one will.
Yeah, I almost look to the membership of the NRA on this one, because I am sure there are many members of the NRA who are, you know, members in good standing for many years who do not support what LaPierre had to say there, who's just being a wild man. And if there could be a movement from within the organization that says, no, we're hunters, we don't believe in assault weapons or these ridiculous, you know, barrels of guns, and there's no reason for anybody to hold one or own one, maybe you would be able to see some change to give the backbone to the Congress that they need.
Well, let's hope new year, new resolutions, maybe something different will come out of that. Finally, usually we conclude our Week in Review segments with the hubbub, as you two know well, those stories that maybe didn't get the front page of attention that they might have deserved. So today, as part of our year-end review, we want to talk about your big story of the last year that we might want to keep in mind. John, I'll start with you.
Well, I'm probably just rubbing my face with a brick here, but I'm going to issue one more protest about the disintegrating line between advertising and editorial content. This happens with advertising and entertainment content. I don't really care about that so much. I mean, I do, but I don't. I'm really concerned about the acceleration of this in the news business, and more the cooperation of the, or even sometimes instigation of, media organizations in presenting marketing material as editorial content. They're dressing it up more and more in the trappings of the actual content that they produce. This is especially true on the web. And it's all information, and they've convinced themselves that this is what people want. This is what consumers want. They keep saying ads are so intrusive. They just want a seamless flow of information. I think that they're selling the public a bill of goods, but I also think that they're eroding their credibility in a way that they will never be able to recover from.
Mm. Hear, hear.
Renee.
That was very well put.
That was. Hear, hear.
I just wanted to say something about Mayor Menino, who, you know, is facing a very difficult and important decision about whether he is going to seek another term. He's, you know, suffering from health problems now, and he's had a terrific run. I was just reminded the other day of way back in 1983 when Kevin White, another mayor, long-term third-term mayor, made the announcement that he was not going to be seeking re-election. Right before that, he told a colleague of mine at the Globe, he said, you know, the politics of getting out are sometimes more complicated than the politics of getting in. And I thought that was so true of the situation, too, because, you know, to unwind the mayor's, you know, sort of grip on his administration, to figure out what he might do instead, you know, to try to figure out how to maintain his legacy and the issues that he cares about, you know, against a you know, successor who might not agree. I mean, this makes running for office look like easy.
Well, here's my story from 2012 that I want to focus a little bit on, and that is the continuing decline of the working and middle class in America. It's one of those stories that goes on, easy to overlook, but this past year there were more reminders of how that American dream is sort of falling increasingly out of reach to more and more Americans. Here are three indicators. Poverty rate. 50 million Americans, more than 16% of the population, are living in poverty. Wages. Continuing flat wage growth has actually declined when considered in real terms. College debt. The price of college, we know, continues to rise. Two-thirds of college seniors graduating with more than $26,000. So a system of higher ed that was once the great equalizer in this country is now becoming available only to those lucky enough to afford it. So that's my big story for 2012, and it amazes me that we have a government today, anyway, in Washington, that is struggling to resolve a fiscal crisis, Renee, that you pointed out so intelligently, that they manufactured instead of talking about how to help move people out of poverty, help to ensure that wages keep pace with the cost of living, and help kids afford college. So there.
And on that cheery note, Happy New Year.
Let's hope for a better one in 2013. John Carroll, communications professor at BU, and Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston. Thank you both very much, and Happy New Year indeed to both of you.
Thanks, Anthony.
Stay with us. Coming up,
writing a song is sort of like an OCD thing. You enter this loop, and for the next 48 hours, that's almost all you're doing.
And he's been doing it for over 22 years. Singer-songwriter Ellis Paul joins us live in the studio. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.